Hi everybody, my name is Mr. Barlow and welcome to episode 37 of the VCE Biology Podcast. This episode covers part of Unit 4, Area of Study 2, and I'll be talking about evolution, including the evidence that supports evolutionary theory, as well as the various patterns of evolution. So the concept that species can change over time, over very long periods of time, and give rise to new species is known as evolution. You've probably heard of a guy called Charles Darwin. Well, he, along with Alfred Wallace, developed the theory of evolution by natural selection. Now, Charles Darwin, he wrote a book, and he wrote it in 1859, and it's called On the Origin of the Species, and it's one of the most famous works of scientific literature of all time, really, and it's really the foundation of evolutionary biology, and this is what this podcast is about, evolution. Now, planet Earth is actually about 4.5 billion years old, so that's 4,500 million years old. And the first evidence of life on Earth appeared about 3,850 million years ago. And it wasn't until about 620 million years ago that the first multicellular animals appeared in the fossil record. So we're talking about a really long period of time. So when we're studying the evolutionary history of our planet, we need a way to determine how old the fossils are, or you know, how old the rocks that are surrounding the fossils that we find. We need to figure out how old all of those things are. So if you find a fossil and you want to find out how old it is, there's two general ways to, you know, age or date something. The first way is to figure out the fossil's relative age, and you do that by looking at other rocks or fossils found around the fossil that you found. So, for example, there's this principle of superposition, which basically means that if you find a fossil somewhere, the fossil or the rock above that fossil will be newer or younger than the fossil you found, and the rock underneath the fossil will be older than the fossil you found. So if you can find out, you know, the age of the things around it, then you'll be able to estimate the age of the fossil, you know, relative to the rocks or, you know, fossils found above and below it. And of course, rocks found above something must be younger because they must have been laid down on top of the fossil that you found. So that, you know, they must have got there later. Now, in finding out the relative age of, you know, a fossil find, you can also use the principle of correlation, and this allows you to figure out the relative age of, you know, rocks or fossils in different parts of the world, basically by comparing them to some distinctive index fossils. So some fossils are only found in particular areas which, you know, only occur in particular time frames in the Earth's geological history. So if you find another fossil which occurs, you know, in the same place where those index fossils are found, then you know that your new fossil find must be around about the same age as those special index fossils. Now, the second general way to find out the age of a fossil or a geological structure is to find out structure's absolute age. And the most important method of finding out the absolute age of a rock or a fossil is by radiometric dating. And this is done basically by using some certain special radioactive elements. And this works because some radioactive isotopes break down at a very regular known rate over a very, very long period of time. And we know exactly how long it takes for half of a radioactive isotope to break down from its, you know, radioactive parent isotope to a more stable atom. And this is called the half-life. So we know the half-life of lots of radioactive isotopes. So, for example, the radioactive isotope potassium-40 decays to a stable daughter atom, argon-40, And it takes 1.25 billion years for half of the radioactive isotope potassium-40 to decay into argon-40. So the half-life of this potassium-argon dating is 1.25 billion years. So if you use potassium-argon dating, you can find out the age of rocks that are, you know, billions and billions of years old. As a quick aside, importantly, when you're dating rocks, you can only really date igneous rocks, and these are rocks which have formed after volcanoes. Other types of rocks, like sedimentary rocks, could be a mix of igneous rocks and, you know, other rocks. So rocks which have basically formed during volcanoes are the ones that you want to date. And yeah, if you use potassium argon dating, you can date rocks, you know, pretty precisely to billions and billions of years old. Now, if you want to, if you found a fossil and so an organic substance, and you want to find out how old it is, another type of radiometric dating is carbon dating. And basically, the stable isotope carbon-12 is found in living things, but there's also a radioactive isotope called carbon-14, and they're in constant proportions. So if we basically look at the amount of carbon-12 and carbon-14 in a fossil, we can carbon date a fossil to a particular age. So the half-life of carbon-14 is 5,730 years, but in fact, using carbon dating, we can date, you know, organic material as long as it's not older than about 60,000 years. Another way to absolutely date something is another technique called electron spin resonance. And it's actually capable of dating organic material which has ages from about 50,000 to 500,000 years old. So just to quickly sum up, if you want to find out how old something is, you can either date it relative to the rocks around it using the principle of superposition, you know, the rocks above or below it, or the principle of correlation by looking at index fossils, or you can figure out the absolute age of a fossil or a geological structure by using either radiometric dating, or for organic material, you can use carbon dating or electron spin resonance. So how was the theory of evolution both discovered and confirmed? Well, like all science, it was done by looking at a great deal of evidence, and some of the best evidence for evolution is fossils. So fossils provide evidence for all kinds of organisms that lived on Earth in the past. So we've found, you know, fossils of animals, you know, bones and teeth, but we've also found trace fossils of animals, and trace fossils are things like footprints or tooth marks. And the fossil record very clearly reveals that over time, changes have occurred in organisms, and they've been, you know, it's been a steady, gradual change. It's basically been an evolution. Now, we find fossils all over the world, of organisms all over the world, and every time we date fossils, we find that they all appear in a very consistent order. So if we find one organism, we find that, you know, we find one organism in two different places, we find that that organism existed at the same time. There's no randomness to it, and we find that organisms that existed before or after, you know, that fossil, they'll always appear in a particular order. And this is known as the law of fossil succession. So we can see this gradual change of organisms. And we can also find, when we look through the fossil record, we might see two organisms, and we can see that they're, you know, somewhat similar, and we might think that, that one organism evolved from the other. And this kind of evidence is backed up by things called transitional fossils. So transitional fossils are basically evidence of organisms that had characteristics that were intermediate in nature to organisms that existed both before it in Earth's history and after it. So there's not only, you know, an illustration that fossils, you know, the organisms gradually changed, but there's these transitional fossils of organisms kind of halfway between different species that we've found. So it's very, very clear evidence of gradual change, you know, or evolution. But there's also evidence in organisms that live today of evolution. For example, all of the mammals that live today share a common ancestor sometime, you know, thousands, millions and millions of years ago. And because they share a common ancestor, they share some similar structures. So when different organisms have similar structures, they're what's called homologous structures. For example, the forelimbs of all mammals are very similar. We've all got kind of the same number of bones in our toes and our ankles and, you know, our leg bones. They're all very, they're different, but they're very similar. So they're called homologous structures. Now, there's also analogous structures, and they're structures in organisms that do look similar or have a similar function, but they don't have an evolutionary or ancestral source. So, for example, insect or fly wings, you know, insects use them to fly, they look similar and have a similar function to bats' wings, but bats are mammals and flies are insects, so they don't share common ancestry. So those wings, they're analogous structures, and they're, you know, they're very different to homologous structures. So some more evidence that evolution has taken place over Earth's history is the presence of vestigial organs in different animals. So vestigial organs are homologous characteristics that have basically lost all or most of their original function in a species through evolution. So there's a couple of good examples of this. One is whales. So whales evolved from land-living ancestors. So their land-living evolutionary ancestors had legs, and whales actually have small vestigial leg bones in their bodies. So why do whales need leg bones? Well, they don't, but their ancestors did. So their leg bones are called, you know, vestigial bones. Humans actually show some vestigial behaviors and reflexes. For example, the formation of goosebumps in humans under stress is a vestigial reflex. So its function in our ancestors was both to raise our body hair at times of stress to make us appear larger, scaring off predators, and also to raise our hair so that it could trap a layer of heat. Neither of those two things work anymore because we're not very hairy. Well, I don't know about you, I'm not. So this raising of the goosebumps is basically a vestigial reflex. So, you know, there's vestigial organs, vestigial parts of animals which are no longer of any use, but were of use in an organism's evolutionary ancestor. And that's another great example of evolution. Some really good example, some evidence of evolution is can be found by basically comparing the embryos of lots of different species. So this provides, you know, really strong evidence. For example, in all terrestrial vertebrates, so reptiles, birds, mammals, heaps and heaps of really different organisms, you know, chickens, pigs, cows, rabbits, humans, all of those embryos actually have, at very early stage of development, have non-functional gill slits, you know, like in your neck. And this is a developmental leftover from their aquatic past. So all land animals actually evolved from aquatic animals. And although we obviously don't need gill slits anymore, they're still present in our embryos. And it shows very clear evolutionary evidence that we all evolved from, you know, some long gone aquatic animal. Now, if you want to discover the evolutionary relationship of two different species, one of the great ways to do it is to look at the similarities of the two species' biochemical and genetic composition. So what that basically means is to look at the organism's proteins and their DNA. Now, the ability to compare proteins made by different species is possible because of the fact that all proteins in all organisms are composed of the same set of 20 amino acid building blocks. So if there's two organisms and they've got a fairly similar protein, if you look at the amino acid sequence of that protein and then compare the two species' proteins, you'll be able to see how similar or how different the amino acid sequences are. So obviously, the more similar the amino acid sequences are of a protein between two species, the shorter time ago that they diverged in evolutionary terms, and the more different their protein sequence is, the longer ago they diverged, their ancestors diverged. So analyzing proteins is one way to establish evolutionary relationships. Now, along a similar vein, All DNA from all living things is, as we know, is composed of the same series of A's, T's, C's and G's. So it's also possible to compare the DNA of different species to each other to establish evolutionary relationships. So there's a few ways to do this. One of the ways to compare the DNA of different species is to do what's called a DNA-DNA hybridization. So what you do there is you get the double-stranded DNA from two species, either, you know, a big stretch of DNA or a particular gene you're interested in, and you heat it so that the double-stranded DNA separates into two single strands. Then you mix the single strands from the two different species and cool it down, and then if it gets cold enough, those two single strands from the different species will bond together. So they'll bond together because some of the base pairs in the two species' stretches of DNA will be complementary to each other. So that, you know, the A's will bond with the T's and the C's will bond with the G's and the two strands will you know, bond together. But they'll bond together more strongly if the DNA sequence is more similar, and they won't bond as strongly together if the DNA sequence is less similar. So what we can do then is we can measure the temperature at which those two different species of DNA strands melt apart or become single-stranded again. So the more heat we have to give to two different species' DNA when it's bonded together, the more heat we have to give it for it to melt apart, the more similar those two DNA strands are, and therefore the more similar those two species are, and therefore a shorter period of time has elapsed since those two species diverged. Another way to compare the DNA of different species to each other is simply to sequence it. So figure out the exact order of the A's, T's, C's and G's of different species for similar stretches of DNA or similar genes. And then by comparing the sequences of genes from different species, you can establish the evolutionary relationship of those species to each other. So scientists have done lots of studies comparing the DNA sequences of different organisms to each other, and what they've found is that sometimes some genes, the DNA sequence of some genes is very similar between a large range of species, even though they're not necessarily closely related in evolutionary terms. And what those genes, a gene which is very similar across many different species, is called a conserved gene. And a conserved gene is normally one that plays basically a vital role in the survival of that organism. So a good example of a conserved gene is the gene encoding hemoglobin. So obviously hemoglobin is important to carry oxygen around the body. And therefore the gene that encodes hemoglobin in many different organisms, you know, is actually very similar. So, you know, the hemoglobin gene is an example of a conserved gene. So you can compare the amino acid sequence of proteins to establish evolutionary relationships. You can do DNA-DNA hybridizations to figure out evolutionary relationships. You can just simply sequence DNA stretches to figure out how similar organisms' DNA is. And you can also actually analyze the chromosomes of different species to establish how similar or how different they are, and therefore to establish evolutionary relationships. So one of the ways you can analyze chromosomes from different species is to look at the special chromosome banding patterns on a karyotype, and you can kind of see where chromosomes are either very, very similar, or, you know, bits of chromosome from one species have duplicated or been deleted or joined onto another chromosome. And we've also got this technique now where you can actually paint chromosomes with this fluorescent dye. So you can, you know, paint all of chromosome 2 with a fluorescent dye, and let's say it's orange or something, and then you can put that same dye in with, you know, chimpanzee DNA and find which chromosomes are homologous with the human chromosomes. And you can see that species which are closely related in terms of evolution have actually very similar arrangements of chromosomes as well. Now, when scientists have done biochemical evolutionary studies, they've discovered something called the molecular clock concept. And basically, this is that changes in the amino acid subunits of any given protein occur at an approximately constant rate over geological time. So, for example, you know, a particular protein, as it evolves or as it changes over time, one amino acid might change in one particular protein maybe every 5 million years. So after 5 million years, one amino acid will change in the protein. After 10 million years, there'll be two amino acid changes. After 15 million years, there'll be three amino acid changes, and so on. But basically, this is good because it can be used to estimate the time since two species diverged. So with that example of a protein where one amino acid changes every 5 million years, if we find two species and we look at their amino acid sequence for a particular protein and we find that maybe there are 100 amino acid differences in the protein, well then we might be able to estimate that those two species diverged about 500 million years ago. So it sounds pretty fantastic. Importantly, the molecular clock doesn't give you a precise time when two species diverged, but it is good at giving you an estimation. And interestingly, the rate at which amino acid sequences change can be very different for different proteins. So proteins that are really vital for the functioning and survival of an organism often evolve or change more slowly than proteins which are less vital for the absolute survival of the organism. But yeah, that's the molecular clock concept, and it says that, you know, amino acids change at a fairly consistent rate over evolutionary time. So evolution's been happening on Earth for millions and millions of years, and we can actually observe different patterns of evolution. So there's divergent evolution, and divergent evolution is when two closely related species become more dissimilar or more different over time, you know, over evolutionary time as they gradually change and evolve. So a good example of this is humans and chimpanzees. So we both evolved from a common ancestor. That ancestor would have lived a very, very long time ago. So while you can see that humans and chimpanzees have some homologous structures, so, you know, we've got four limbs and fingers and toes and eyes and nose and mouth are in a very similar place in our head, we've also got fairly significant differences. So, you know, humans walk upright, we're bigger and taller than chimpanzees, so we're different. So that's an example of divergent evolution. So we've got more different than chimpanzees over time. Another type of or pattern of evolution is convergent evolution. So this is actually where two very different species evolve structures that have very similar or analogous functions. So even though their evolutionary ancestors may be very, very dissimilar and unrelated, they've evolved either to look, you know, the same in general, or they've both evolved a very, very similar structure, which possibly serves a very, very similar purpose. And a really great example of this is eyes in both mammals and cephalopods. So mammals and cephalopods are very, very, very different. You know, cephalopods, like a squid, lives in the ocean, and mammals like us, we live on land, but we both have an eye which shares, you know, heaps of similarities, but we share a common ancestor, you know, like billions of years ago. So although we're not even closely related, we've got this convergent evolution of the structure of the eye. Obviously eyes, there's a really good way for an eye to evolve, and it evolved a very similar way in cephalopods and, you know, in mammals. So that's an example of convergent evolution. So another pattern of evolution is parallel evolution. And this is where a similar trait or characteristic evolves in two different species, which are often, you know, similar. So often you get two similar species which are living in the same environment. And due to the same environmental pressures, those two species will independently evolve to have very similar characteristics. The last pattern of evolution I'll talk about is coevolution, and this is when there's changes in two very different species that have a close interaction, like they live in symbiosis. So, for example, a parasite and a host, or predator and its prey, and they'll evolve, you know, kind of together, and it's called coevolution. Now, a great example of coevolution is the way that some birds' beaks have evolved and some flowers have evolved to kind of fit together really nicely. A great example of this is hummingbirds and ornithophilous flowers, so a particular type of flower. And the hummingbird's beak, which is, you know, kind of rounded, fits really nicely into the kind of rounded ornithophilous flower. And so the hummingbird can feed from the flower, so drink the nectar from the flower. But the flower then uses the bird as a pollinator. So they kind of help each other out. And as a result, they've got this, you know, co-evolution of the shape of the flower and the shape of the beak. So I've been talking all about the way, you know, all these species evolve. Well, very importantly, the process of the formation of a new species via evolution is known as speciation. And there are two types of speciation. First of all, there's phyletic evolution, and this is basically where one species changes gradually over time and is ultimately recognized as a new species. So, you know, if it were possible and you got the current version of that species and then could take that version of that species back in time to its ancestor, those two, you know, individuals wouldn't be able to reproduce. So they're distinct species, even though it's just kind of, you know, it's been the one group of organisms, but there has been this gradual change in over time. The other type of speciation is branching evolution or divergent evolution. And this is where the population of one species splits into two, and one part of the population evolves separately or differently to form a new species, which is distinct and very different from the original or the other species. Now, this often happens when one species is split geographically, and particularly if one half of that species is in a new environment, the environmental pressures might be different, and therefore, you know, they'll evolve differently to form eventually over, you know, a long period of time, two different species. So yeah, speciation is the process of forming new species, and that's either phyletic evolution or branching evolution. Now, of course, species can also be lost from Earth's biodiversity. So, you know, there's millions and millions of species on Earth. But, of course, sometimes a species dies off. And when that happens and there's no more of that species around, it's said to be extinct. And, of course, once a species is extinct, that's it. It's gone forever. And that brings episode 37 of the VC Biology Podcast to a close. I'm Mr. Barlow, and thanks for listening.